I just don't want to get so lost that it becomes like embarrassing that I end up having to get airlifted out or something. And yeah, become one of those stories of miserable failures. I just want to be a regular failure like everyone else.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again. It is the Dom and Colin podcast. I am Colin, here alongside Dom. Dom, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am doing very well. We have something really special, I think, to talk about today. You know, normally we're talking about reality TV for the most part. You know, we occasionally mix in certain other things, but one thing that we have been really hoping to do a lot more of, we've dabbled in it from time to time, but we are really hoping to make more of an effort to talk more about documentary movies, I think, is something that both of us very much enjoy and I think oftentimes make for compelling kind of discussions. So we thought, let's have more of those on air. And today we are back with another one. Today we are here to talk about a couple of movies, I suppose, primarily about one movie called The Barkley Marathons, which is available on Amazon, and a second movie, which is about one person in particular trying to, going through the Barkley Marathons, and that is called Where Dreams Go to Die, and that is available on YouTube. And I would say, but we'll issue an official spoiler warning before we dive into the details, but certainly, as we will hammer home shortly, definitely do watch both of those movies at some point before listening to this podcast. They are both a ton of fun, and I'm certain most people who are just generally into the kind of shows that we talk about would very much enjoy them. So, Dom, where do we want to, I guess, set up for us what the Barkley Marathons are and kind of why we thought this would be interesting to talk about?
So I was going to say, yeah, as we get into the Survivor offseason here, documentaries are just a bottomless well of good content and good stuff to cover. So we would be watching stuff like this anyway. I love documentaries of this genre and a big documentary fan in general. But this is an iron that we've had in the fire, I believe is the expression, for some time now. And because it's not time sensitive, because it's not episodic or week by week, we can always find an excuse to push it back. And if we're strapped for time, this is usually the first thing to go. But now that the schedule is easing up a little bit, we're trying to fit as many of these in as we can, because I love watching these initially. I love rewatching these, and then I love getting to talk about them and share them with a wider audience.
Right. And this is a movie that you first told me about. You said, hey, check out this documentary, The Barkley Marathons, which I did and I very much enjoyed. And I've now seen it three or four times at this point. But again, let's set up, I think, why this one in particular would be of interest.
Yeah, so as someone who does not have really any interest at all in running, either ultramarathon or just running in general, you know, if I'm watching a documentary like this, it's either from the comfort of my couch or occasionally at a leisurely pace on the treadmill at the gym, then this entire world is foreign to me. And I've always been fascinated with documentaries like this, where you're watching people just pursue excellence in some field or another and really push themselves to their limits and compete for the ultimate prize in something. It's usually a topic or a subculture or just some kind of endeavor for whom the yeah, vast majority of the couldn't let that go uncorrected. For whom the vast majority of the audience is going to have no frame of reference at all, and that they can maybe take whatever limited knowledge they have and kind of extrapolate from that or whatever. But for me, it's kind of like the way that when people talk about the national debt, it's like the figures involved are so astronomical that at a certain point they all kind of blur together and you lose a sense of just what the scale is. And it's a similar thing here, where the idea of a 5K can sound intimidating at times. When you get up to a marathon, and God forbid, like 130-mile, like grueling gauntlet of death, it really just all feels like the same thing. So it's not a world that I have any experience of or knowledge of. And so why is this documentary still interesting? And that's the ultimate puzzle that any documentary like this has to solve, whether it's ultramarathons or Scrabble tournaments, which is the subject of another documentary that I hope we get to cover fairly soon. Whatever it is, however, you know, obscure or strange a topic, there's got to be some kind of hook that is going to take someone who knows absolutely nothing about it and didn't know that they were interested in it before they started watching this documentary and keep them watching for the 90 minutes or however long it lasts. And what do you think that factor is here for you? Because I'm assuming you're not a big runner either.
Well, I've actually recently started running a lot. I moved relatively recently. I still have zero friends in my area and very little else to do, but there is a gym in my new building, so I've been running out of sheer boredom, and it's actually not been too bad getting that time down. But for me, I think the hook was just so clear right away in the way that they set up what a borderline impossible kind of task this is, because this is not your standard even 100-mile kind of race. This is a days-long, 130-mile race through, like, the mountains of Tennessee, where over the course of this whole thing, anyone who finishes it will have had more elevation change than if they had climbed and descended Mount Everest twice in that span. And it had been going on for like a couple of decades, 25 years or so, somewhere in there, at the time that this documentary was being filmed, which was the 2012 iteration of the Barkley Marathons. And I think the hook is just, this race is so insane and has been going on for so long, and despite all of the hundreds of people who apply each year, and only the most hardcore runners even know how to get an application, and only 40 of those people even get a shot on a given year, and to then hear only 10 people in the 25-year history of this race have ever even finished, is, I think, as far as documentaries go, one of the strongest hooks I can remember in the opening 5 minutes of recent memory for me.
And when it comes to that challenge of how to make this niche or obscure topic accessible and interesting to an audience, one way to sidestep that almost is to focus on the people instead. So I might not really know or especially care that much what it takes to be the world's best competitive gardener or eater or chess player or whatever. But as long as I care about the people who are trying to be the world's best gardener, eater, chess player, then that story is going to be interesting, because there's a level of human interest there that there maybe isn't if you're just focusing on the topic itself. And so you have this interesting stylistic contrast between the Barkley Marathons, where the central cast of characters who are running the race, they don't jump off the screen at you, and you don't actually get to learn that much about them. Towards the end, one of the runners, as he's on the final lap and he's working towards the finish, he talks about what this means to him and the event in his life that got him interested in ultramarathons and the whole endeavor of trying to push yourself and break yourself like that. But by and large, you don't know that much more about them by the end of the documentary than you do at the beginning. The second documentary that we mentioned, Where Dreams Go to Die, couldn't be more different. In that case, you're focusing on one guy and his quest to conquer his demons and overcome this latest challenge and to really push himself to even further limits. And by himself, he's very well suited for that kind of focus, because he's a YouTuber. He documents a lot of his running adventures and training, so he's used to being in the spotlight and of conveying his story in an interesting way. But also just the format of that, of focusing on one person and following their struggle, is that's the obvious documentary format, and that's the reason why we could happily cover 10 or 15 or 20 different documentaries like this, each focusing on very different topics or challenges, and they would all have roughly the same kind of format, because that's just, it's a recipe that works, and so people keep going back to it. Whereas Barkley, it's more of a story of the race itself and just how cruel and hard it is. And I guess part of that, though, is focusing on one guy, because this is the twisted mind behind the race itself. And this documentary leans so hard on Lazarus Lake, and I think it's much better for having done so.
They truly ran about 5 standard deviations above expectation as far as the guy who is like masterminding this whole endeavor is concerned. He is a man named Lazarus Lake. We'll get more into the specifics when we talk about the beginning of the documentary in the spoiler zone, but suffice to say, this guy alone is worth the price of admission for watching this documentary, and it is not a coincidence that he is featured heavily in both of these.
Absolutely, and I know when I watched this for the first time, I said, you're going to want to watch this because the star of the documentary, in my eyes, is you in 20 or 30 years, which, after you watched it, you took great offense to, and I'm not sure why, because that was the highest compliment I could pay someone.
I believe my exact words were, fuck you, but I see what you're saying.
Right, it's in the same kind of vein as the guy who says of Lazarus, I don't even like the man very much, but I love him. Does this make sense? It's from the same kind of mindset there.
That definitely resonated, yeah. So, Dom, one other thing that I wanted to ask you before we get into the spoiler zone, because I know this is something that would have come up in there, but I think it would be an interesting discussion that we can have without venturing at all into spoiler territory. So I wanted to give the people who haven't seen it yet, I guess, kind of a teaser for what's in store potentially for them when they meet this cast of characters that are going to be running this race. Because one of the common themes, not just in these movies, but apparently across the entire running world, is the people who do marathons and things even more insane than marathons. Marathons by themselves are absolutely nuts and no one should ever do them. But let me make that statement clear right off the bat at the beginning of this podcast. I do not condone marathons in any way. But the people who do them, inexplicably perhaps, are generally very successful in real life, and they touch a little on this in the movie, but I know you've done a little research on this subject as well. It turns out that an insane percentage of super competitive runners have like master's degrees or graduate degrees, if there's a difference between those things, and huge incomes and so forth.
Yeah, and there was actually an article that I read in some kind of journal about how so many scientists, a disproportionate number of scientists, have an interest in this kind of really strenuous, just obscenely over-the-top physical activity. And I guess there's like a duality there, where if you spend all of your time doing something that's scientific and abstract and really working with the mind, then it's a relief and it's a nice change of pace to get heavily involved in something physical and to put yourself there as well. But I feel that that's true of basically anyone who works an office job, and the way that they manifest that duality, if you like, is to just go to the gym occasionally, right? Or they go for a run after work. They don't end up running like 120 miles just for fun, as if it's just another day at work. So there is something curious about what it takes to succeed just in life and to be this just well put together, successful, driven individual, but then also feel the need to drive yourself in this completely different field, which you know is going to wreck you physically, if not mentally. So the poster child for this is Brett, who is also, in one sense, a poster child for the whole documentary as well. He not only has a PhD in physics at Caltech, and his thesis title, to give you a flavor, is Fluidic and Polymeric Integration and Functionalization of Optical Microresonators, which I'm sure is very simple once you get to know it. So he's not only a very successful scientist, obscenely clever, intimidatingly so, perhaps. He also worked on Wall Street for a time, I'm sure was obscenely wealthy after coming out of that. He was a professional poker player. He's done all of these different things, and it feels like he's one of those guys who just waltzes into whatever field he likes and crushes it. Not despite a minimum of effort, because clearly he works very hard and is incredibly driven and wants to succeed and wants to be the best. And even though he's not an emotive guy, he doesn't wear his heart on his sleeve, you can see the passion there. You can see how much this means to him, even if he would never want to admit that publicly. But you wonder if, like, when in heaven, before the pearly gates opened and we were all kicked down to earth, if some people just got really lucky with the dice rolls that gave them their stats for life, right? Because you have these guys like Brett, who you would understand if he was this amazing physicist, but other areas of his life were slacking a little bit, or maybe he wasn't that fit. You would forgive him for that, maybe. And vice versa, if ultra running was his thing, but maybe he wasn't the brightest bulb in the shed, that would be fine too. But instead, he is everything you would want to be and more. And it's almost aggravating watching him and just being jealous, wondering how anyone could just be that good at things in general.
Yeah, I mean, I think a big appeal of running this race in the first place, as I mentioned, only at the time of this documentary being filmed, only 10 people had ever finished the race in the decades-long history of it. And I think that knowledge that this is almost certainly going to end in failure, and even being here is way beyond the scope of what a normal human would do, is not like, I don't think people enter grad school with that exact same mindset, but I do think it's similar, where it's part of the appeal is knowing how hard it's going to be. And I think the Barkley marathons deliver on that, as far as I can tell, unlike pretty much any other race that exists.
And Lazarus has a line to that effect. He says, I think the race appeals to them because they could fail. And once again, that is a relatable impulse. A lot of us strive for challenges which we don't expect to meet, or which we don't expect to be easy, because that process of thinking you could fail is what drives you and what keeps it interesting. It's, you know, kind of the same thing that Christian was alluding to on Survivor, right? With the whole roller coaster thing, where it's like, this this only works as a concept because you have that fear. And, you know, you only want to play a game like that because there's always this, like this sword of Damocles hanging over you that at any moment you could be wrong. You could get blindsided or whatever. But again, for most people, that manifests in much more mundane ways. So this could be, you know, you don't exercise that much. So you go to the gym and you slowly escalate the level of your exercise and you try to work up to some goal that seems unattainable. But as you get there, it comes into view. Whereas for these guys, they're so successful at everything that they have to seek out just monstrously difficult stuff like this just to find things that they could potentially fail at.
I think that's well put. And I think I had two lines written down that I think tie in nicely here. One is from Lazarus, where it's roughly in line with the one that you referenced yourself, where he says, if you want to face a real challenge, you have to face a real challenge. You can't accomplish anything without the possibility of failure. And then later in the movie, they have some clips from an interview with a guy who was one of the early people to finish it back in like the early 90s, and I didn't write his name down, but he's the guy who has very cool sunglasses, very tough guy sunglasses that were very intimidating and really carried on camera. And he said, if you don't truly have to work for something, what reward is there? And I think that mentality is super common in ultra runners and in people with like high levels of education.
Yeah, you also have the one Brit in the documentary, James Adams, who, as he is barring out of the race with his tail between the legs, and you hear taps in the background. Before that, he says something to the effect of, I don't want to be a miserable failure, quote, I just want to be a regular failure like everyone else. And that's...
I don't want to be one of the people who gets airlifted out of here, is I think how it begins.
And that shows you just how nebulous the concept of failure is in a race like this, because there were guys here for whom not finishing the race would be a failure, or even if they finish all five laps, if they don't do it within the allotted time or they don't break their personal best, that would be the ultimate failure to them. They'll go home and kick themselves and try and ratchet it up for next year. But there are some people, again, for whom just finishing the fun run, the first three laps, or even one leg of the race, that's a really big achievement for them. That's the goal that they're striving for. And just showing up to this race is an achievement in itself. If you can be here, if you can find your way here and be chosen to enter the race, first of all, but also think that this is something you could realistically do, you are already so far above 99.9% of other people in this chosen field of yours. And it's like it's almost perverse to think that you failed because you can't reach that 99.999%, right? It's when you look at it objectively like that, it seems so damaging. And yet that's something which, again, is going to be relatable to everyone watching in their own way, in their own chosen hobby.
Right. And we'll talk certainly more about that, about just how insane this race is, that people go into it saying to themselves, if I can even make it 20% of the way through this thing, I'll consider that a victory. And just the relative expectations for all of the different levels of runners that find themselves here.
And that guy, James Adams, he's a highly acclaimed ultramarathon runner. He's done some truly insane feats. So just looking at his website, he lists all of the different races that he's taken part in. And one of them was like this LA to New York race, where over the course of 2 months, you run like 3,000 miles or something. It's just these completely unbelievable athletic achievements. And yet his participation in this documentary is he shows up, he fails, he gives a quote about failing, and then he slinks off and you never see him again. And you would be forgiven for thinking he was a guy who just wandered down from the woods somewhere and saw there was a race going on and decided to take part. Not that he was, you know, one of the world's best at what he's decided to do here.
So Dom, what else, if anything, before we get into the spoiler zone and the specifics of these movies?
Let's dive right in then, because I don't know what we're really trying to avoid spoiling here. I guess who finishes and doesn't finish the race would be one part of it.
I would say it is meaningful watching the movie, knowing versus not knowing who's going to finish or not finish. So I would say if you are going to continue with this podcast and want to be unspoiled, which you absolutely should, I would highly recommend don't listen to the rest of this until you've seen these movies. But once you do, come back and find us right at this timestamp. And again, Barkley Marathons is available on Amazon, and Where Dreams Go to Die is available at least least for now, on YouTube. And I think that is on purpose. I think it is the guy himself putting it on YouTube. So I hope that doesn't come down. I hope that we're not like promoting piracy or whatever. But here is your official warning for the spoiler zone. And we'll give it another few seconds. 3, 2, turn it off or pause now. Be done with us. 1. Anyone still here who hasn't seen these movies, I'm extremely disappointed in. Away we go. Dom, the place we have to start now that we can, I guess, get into the air quotes spoiler zone is, let's begin where the movie begins, with meeting Lazarus Lake, who unfolds this giant map of the state of Tennessee with all of his routes that he's run highlighted over all the decades. Where do we want to dive in on Lazarus, the evil genius behind this whole race?
Well, as his son in spirit, and possibly his actual son, I'm not quite sure yet, I'll let you take the first bite at this.
Okay, well, so Lazarus is someone we learn quickly, despite how he may appear these days, he was originally one of like the OG kind of ultra runners back when that was first becoming a popular thing. And we see his like duffel bag full of all the t-shirts from the marathons he did back in like the 70s and the 80s. And we get to find out a lot about Laz right away, I would say, when we tag along with him as he's driving out to like the race site, and the camera person checks his fuel gauge and sees that it's hovering right on empty. And they say, "Oh, hey, is your fuel gauge broken? What's the issue with that?" And he goes, "No, no problem with the fuel gauge. E means excellent. F means you're fucked. So we are in excellent shape." And that's I think, a perfect snapshot of Laz to really kick him off as a character.
It is brilliant. I was hooked on the documentary from that moment. If only so, I would get to see more of Lazarus. I could take or leave the whole running part. You know, that's a sideshow at this point. This is the Lazarus Lake show. And if there is an official sequel one day, I really hope they just lean in on that as hard as they possibly can.
Yeah, and so we hear from Lazarus about how the race came to be, and it was based apparently off of the James Earl Ray prison escape, which took place in a nearby prison where he ran off into the woods and was eventually captured about 8 miles away from the prison. And Lazarus made some offhand remark about how he said he could get 100 miles away over the course of the amount of time that James Earl Ray had. And that was like the origin of how this whole idea came to be. And we find out that the way this works is Lazarus every year maps out and a route that changes annually, and somehow miraculously always calculates out to 20.0 miles per lap, although apparently it's closer to about 26 in reality per loop, I should say. Is it loop? Loop. Not lap. I should know. I've seen the movie enough times. But
Either or.
But I think the movie does a really good job right away setting up, as I mentioned when you said what really hooked me into it, is setting up just the aura of how daunting of a challenge this race is in the matter of a few minutes. I think they do a really good job setting up, yes, you've heard about people in passing running 100-mile races, and that sounds insane, but here's the granddaddy of them all, and you're going to actually get to see what it's like in practice.
Initially, you wonder how much of this might be a mirage of whether Lazarus has gone to great lengths and been very successful in cultivating this air of fear and mystery around the race. But then once you actually get down to it, if you're someone who is a seasoned ultra marathon runner, then you'll find your feet and you'll know what you're doing and it'll be fine. And it turns out, no, this is real. This is serious. And even the people who are just battle-hardened veterans at this, they are you see them wondering why they're doing this to themselves, right? You see them, they know what they're in store for over the next few days, and they know that by the end, even if they succeed, they will be certainly destroyed physically and mentally. It's going to take some time to recover too, and yet they seem almost enthusiastic. They relish that prospect, and that's what keeps them coming back here when time and time again. And that's why there's a waiting list. You have to go through this application process to apply. You can't just pay the entry fee and sign up. You have to write an essay. You have to do all of these things to get in here. And there's I think by keeping it exclusive, it reinforces that sense of mystery, right? It is, if you can get in and you do get in, then you feel like you've achieved something and you're committed to at least try your hardest to complete whatever your goal is in the race, even when you get out there and you realize this is the worst thing I've ever done to myself, why am I so stupid?
Right. And I think one of the most crucial elements to all of this is it seems like Lazarus is overtly rooting against people finishing this race, and he wants it to be right on the brink of what is even humanly possible. Like, I think one of the funniest things about it is when you are selected to be one of the 40 people who actually gets to participate, the letter of acceptance says, "We regret to inform you that you've been selected to participate in the Barkley marathons." And I think that comes through to all of the people running it. Like, to pull something from Where Dreams Go to Die, which I'm sure everybody listening to this has seen right now, we will go on to learn that Jared Campbell becomes the first three-time finisher, and they make it clear in that movie that every single time someone finishes, Laz makes it even harder. And I think Lazarus constantly wants it to be the situation where even the Jared Campbells of the world are still finishing this at like 59 hours 30 minutes.
Right. And Lazarus deliberately lets in someone who he wants and expects to fail as a quote human sacrifice, just to drive home the point of how
that
hard
is something
this is.
I would do. That's yeah. Very fair to say that to compare him to me.
Just to emphasize how foolhardy this entire project is, in case there are any doubts. So.
Yeah, and this year we get a fun human sacrifice in the form of Tim Hardy, I believe is the guy's name. He seems to have some sort of military background, and he ends up making it, I think, 6 or 7 hours before he ends up having taps played for him, which is another very fun element. Whenever someone drops out, they get tapped at the starting gate, which is a ton of fun. Although, at a certain point, you got to start feeling bad for that bugle guy, right? Like, isn't that repetitive?
I feel worse for the people who have to run however many miles it is, destroy their bodies, stay up for 60 hours without sleeping. But yeah, I'm sure the bugle guy is having a hard time of it too.
I don't know. I think his name was Danger Dave, and I think he's the real victim here.
There's another underrated thing about this documentary too, how you have Lazarus, who really is the star of the show, but the whole like secondary cast of Lazarus associates is great too. You have Raw Dog, who is never really there's no character development for Raw Dog. He's just introduced as Raw Dog, as like the good cop to Lazarus' bad cop, and that's his entire role in the documentary. But somehow the fact that he's named Raw Dog tells you all you really need to know about who he is.
By the way, sorry to cut you off, but he is on Amazon. The lead cast is listed exclusively as Lazarus Lake, comma, Raw Dog.
Right, it sounds like some like WrestleMania style thing, right?
I know, I was thinking Lazarus Lake sounds like some sketchy lagoon on a Dungeons and Dragons map.
It really does, yeah. So you have them, you have Dave, and finally, at the very end of the documentary, in a unexpected but somehow very fitting and very fun twist, we finally meet the eponymous Barry Barkley, who it turns out is not some fabled marathon runner who wowed the world with his Olympian feats of athleticism. He's just a farmer who Lazarus knows and decided to name a race after for reasons which Barry Barkley himself is not really privy to.
Yeah, that closing scene is, hey, why did you name it the Barkley Marathons? And we get to go out to Barry Barkley's farm and spend some time with him. And it made me wonder, because Lazarus says the explanation is there was just something about the character of the race that he thought Barry Barkley's name would fit perfectly on. And my question is Barry Barkley just like a total jerk to everyone he meets, just like trying to take everybody down?
I think maybe Lazarus is that instead, but it must be so weird to just be a friend of Lazarus, right? Like, I don't know what that term even means for him, because it must be so trying in a way where like everything he does, you know, there's some like ironic subtext behind it, or there's some weird experiment, or just I'm sure it's a trip, I'm sure he's a fun guy to be around, but after a while you have to start just questioning everything about him, right?
Yeah, he would not be my go-to person to rely upon for rides, if his fuel gauge is any indication. But yeah, I would imagine it'd be quite fun. Like time would fly, I would imagine, just any scenario hanging out with Lazarus.
He's one of those people who you feel like you never really know as a person, but you get to know him really well as a character. Even if you've known the guy for 35 years, that's always the level of distance you have with him.
I mean, if you told me that 35 years ago, Lazarus Lake was some PhD student like Brett who wrote the most comprehensive thesaurus on whatever molecular kind of scientific garbage you want to throw out there for your thesis title, I would believe you. And I would also believe you if you told me that 35 years ago, Lazarus Lake successfully strung together a string of 6 serial murders and got away with it.
Yeah, he was selling drugs and sleeping under a bridge somewhere. Right. Like, that's really, his range is limitless.
Absolutely, yeah. So you referenced quickly, but I wanted to dive into this a little more because I think this adds a fun element to the race and certainly to the documentary, that application process where we don't even find out the specifics. All we hear is it's a very mysterious process, and if you're someone who should be running this race, you would know how to get an application for this race. And even after all these years, Dom, the application still only costs $1.60 to submit. And Lazarus, whether he accepts you or not, he's going to keep that $1.60. So the joke is really on you, my friend, about you thinking this is a cheap entry fee.
And there are a few things that go into that pricing structure. So first of all, it was explicitly intended as a middle finger against the typical ultramarathon community, where the entry fee scales with the length of the race. So it's usually $1 a mile. And he made it 1 cent a mile instead, just as a statement of purpose there. But also, Lazarus says that he feels like the clientele is different. So if you have to jump through all of these hoops and so on, and you don't have the $160, let's say, entry fee keeping people out, then you just get a different crowd with a different vibe than you might get if everyone there is hardcore and professional and is there to work instead of there to play. I don't know how true that is. It feels like if you are going through all this work in the first place, whether or not it's $1.60, $160, or even more than that, that's not going to be a deterrent, right? There's no one who's showing up in Tennessee, but then getting second thoughts when they see how much it costs. So I think the real reason is what he goes on to say, which is he doesn't want to have to feel complaints about his own professionalism, right? Because if you show up and you paid $160, you expect a certain level of care and attention, and you expect there to at least be maybe some cones on the course, or you expect this to be a real production. Whereas this time around, if you've paid your $1.60, you've paid your sock or your shirt or whatever it is, you really have no right to complain. You can take that and go home with it if you really like.
Oh, would you like your license plate back as a refund? Yeah, I thought that was a ton of fun to see from Lazarus, and certainly something that 30 years from now I could see being a future Colin Stone move for sure. So point there for you as well, Dom. And I thought it was cool that transitioned into meeting one of who I guess I'm going to call the stars of the show, grad student John. We are our first sight of this guy who's going to go on to be kind of the David against these Goliaths is him talking about how excited he was that the race only cost $1.60. So it was totally not a burden on his budget in any way. And he, not coincidentally, I'm sure, is someone like we were talking about earlier, who is at this point in his life a grad student studying climate change. So another scientist here for the books, Dom.
Yeah, and Lazarus says that entry fee makes it open to anyone, and John echoes that in his comments. But when you dig a little deeper and you look at the numbers here, it turns out that just to do this, and it's not surprising when you think about it, but it's never really made explicit in the documentary, you have to be at least somewhat wealthy to firstly get the time and the preparation in to go for something like this. But also, it does correlate with what we said earlier, where the type of people who are driven to push themselves to these extremes are doing the same in their regular lives, in their careers. And so they're making a lot of money, or they're high flyers in their jobs. And so it's no surprise that, to quote the article that I mentioned before, is something like 47% of trail runners and 73% of running USA members make more than $75,000 a year. Quote, the median household income of ultra running subscribers is $122,000. 55% of triathletes make more than $100,000. And you alluded to this yourself, almost 90% of triathletes have attended college or more, compared to 30% of the general population. And so for a pursuit which seems to have no bearing or correlation whatsoever with your just intelligence level, that's a really startling statistic there at the end.
Right. I mean, I think there is a direct bearing on determination level. But to be fair, I also think there is a direct bearing on not everyone can afford to take as much time off to train for that sort of thing as is necessary, I would imagine, to run these ultra marathons.
Yeah, and you're flying all over the world to compete in these races. You have guys here from the UK, as we said, from Europe, from elsewhere as well. So this really is your thing, right? Like, it's not like you can have this side by side with another hobby and, oh, you dabble in this and then you dabble in that when you have the time. If you are a runner, then you are a runner. Like, this is what you are. And so for a lot of these people, this is a big part of their identity, right? You don't show up to the Barclay just as a casual day off. This is something which you have to take seriously because that's what you've decided to do with yourself.
Right. And I think that comes through with most people, although I would say, frankly, with John, maybe this is just creative editing, but it really didn't seem to me, certainly at least at the beginning and even after seeing his final result, like running was everything he had going on in his life. Like, as you alluded to earlier, he talks about how running helped him get through a lot of things that he was going on in his own personal life. And he certainly does a very good job in this race. But with at least Brett and Jared and the guy Gary in the other movie, it really seemed like running was, at least at the time the Barclay was going on, the vibe I got was running was the only thing in the world that mattered to them. Whereas for whatever reason, and again, maybe this was the editing, John seemed like much more of like a normal guy who just happened to be in this race.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. Did you get a similar vibe from like that?
Well, they all seem fairly normal, right? Because Laz was by himself. He is the most eccentric it is possible to be. And so maybe everyone else just seems normal by comparison. But I think by and large, they all just seem like fairly, I don't want to say unremarkable, because just being here in the first place is incredibly remarkable. But you wouldn't just like, you wouldn't think twice if you just pass them on the street, right? They just seem like perfectly normal, well-adjusted people.
Yeah. No, I'm with that. Like, we talked about how none of these three guys that we're going to see end up finishing this race really would jump off the page as far as like documentary characters would be concerned in pretty much any other context. But even despite that, I think just because of the sheer magnanimity of this endeavor, it's impossible not to understand what kind of insane experience they're going through, even if they aren't like the most expressive people in the world.
Let's go with a magnitude there. I believe.
All right, well, fine, Dom. You and your fancy Oxford words.
Yeah,
I can't try to just invent something to fit in.
I will preface this by saying, if we somehow get the chance to talk to Brett or John or whatever, I would leap on that. I think it would be really fun. But they're the type of people who clearly are doing something very interesting, and the fact that they're driven to do it at all is very curious. But I don't know how interesting they would be to interview, solely because if you're Brett and you just succeed at everything, then you're not really driven to examine the reasons why or to engage in any kind of like introspection, right? You just show up and you crush it and then you move on to your next thing. And he himself, he always takes this very matter-of-fact attitude. So even at the end of lap four in the race, when he comes back from the pit stop and his legs are literally falling apart and you see those horrible blisters on his feet and you can tell the guy is going through agony, there's no sense of like performance about it, right? He does what he needs to do and he goes on and he does it. And it's very methodical and very practiced, and it's amazing to watch, but I don't know how interesting it is to watch, if that makes sense.
Well, I think Brett is, and all of the people who are doing this are the types of people for whom that sort of thing is certainly not a surprise, and they have a plan in mind in the event that something like that were to happen. Like when we see many shots of people's feet totally destroyed, but they are always quickly followed by shots of them getting powdered in dry socks.
Sure, right. But those shots for me work so well because if you're trying to convey to people just how brutal and grueling the race is, you can have this montage of people talking about how it's X miles long and you have to go through Y feet of elevation up and down, and you have the graphic with Mount Everest side by side, and that's all well and good. But in a way, I think just showing someone those blisters does much more to lock it in their minds how terrible this is than any statistic you could possibly quote on the matter.
A blister says 1,000 words.
Something like that, yeah.
I think that's how the saying goes, yeah. So I guess we end up meeting Brett in much more depth than we see Jared, who also is going, I mean, I guess it is because Brett, when they were entering this race was a returning guy who had finished it last year, and I believe is like the first person ever who has done it once and been willing to go back and want to do it again, which I thought was interesting. And what did you, make of that, of the idea that, as far as I can tell, other than Jared, who the years in later years would go back and go on to finish it three times, it really does seem like a testament to the idea of the race, as far as I am concerned. Like the idea, Lazarus's vision, that this is much more about the accomplishment than the actual experience, that Brett is literally the first person ever, it seems, to go back for more.
It says a lot by itself that someone who puts himself through all of that and succeeds, it's not a one and done thing. They feel the need to go through that again. And you've already proven that you can do it. So there must be some extra ingredient there, whether it's just doing it again, prove something extra, or something missing, which maybe can never fully be satisfied. And just doing this over and over again in a quest to chase that, but maybe in vain. That's the essence of what this is, right? It's pushing yourself to these extremes. Knowing that you can never fully reach it, and there's always something new that you can, there's always some new frontier that you have to try and cross.
Well, I think in specifically Brett's case, he did the Barkley Marathon in 2011, became the 10th person ever to finish, and this goes back to what we were just talking about. It seems like Brett is just wired to say to himself, I could have done better. I want to go back and get the new time record. I want to set the all-time speed record. And he ends up doing that at the end of this movie. And I don't know about Jared's time in 2014 or like John Allen's time, but I would guess that Brett probably still has the time record, given that Jared in 2016 ended up finishing with half an hour to spare. It seems like the course is a bit more difficult.
And you see littered throughout the documentary, all of these people who they run the race, and some of them are running for the third time, the fourth time, or the fifth time, and they haven't finished it yet. And some of them haven't even finished a fun run. And I say haven't even as if that's something to look down upon. But again, we're talking about the inside of the 1% here. And I wonder what the dynamic must be for those people who come so close and make such a valiant effort, but can never quite get there, to see the people like Brett or Jared who do it and come back and do it again and make it look so comparatively effortless, even though they know as well as Brett and Jared do that it's agony for everyone out there.
Well, I think the knowledge that even the other people out there on these loops with him, the most hardcore runners who want to put themselves through this, most of them, the vast, vast, vast majority will come nowhere near finishing, is what makes it so rewarding for the people like Brett. And for in his specific case, I think it was that desire to just being a finisher is still not good enough for me. I have to have the best time ever. And I would imagine that could potentially be what is on Jared's mind as well, given that he seems to keep going back out there. I don't know if three was enough for him or if he's continuing to give it more shots, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if I heard that the reason he's doing that is he wants the time record.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm getting at is, what do you think Brett and Jared, when they look at these people who they know are not on their level yet, and they can try to be, and they're on a higher level than 99.9% of people who could ever consider doing this, but there's clearly a separation, right? Clearly Brett and Jared and the others are on their own tier. How do you think they view the people below them, and what do you think needs to happen for them to gain that kind of acceptance and be brought into that next level?
Finish the Barkley Marathon, I think. Well, is what it takes.
But in a wider sense, like if you're someone who you train for a year and you finally complete a marathon, and that's this amazing achievement for you, and then you hear about this world of ultra marathons and you think, okay, that's the next step, that's what I want to do, what do you have to do to prove yourself and to break into that scene? Because I imagine it's mostly the same people showing up to the same races year in, year out, and so I imagine it must be quite tight-knit, and so there's a sense of camaraderie and solidarity in there, which is great if you're part of that inner circle. But if you're not, I wonder how inviting it really is, because I imagine it could be, and I'm not saying it is, but I imagine it could be, or it could feel quite exclusionary from the outside.
So I was not a big runner in high school, but many of my close friends were on the cross country team in high school and have continued to run a lot in the ensuing years, and around Thanksgiving when they're home, when we're all in our hometown, or at various other holidays, there will be 5K races locally, and they will often compete in these. And I can tell you with certainty, they definitely know the other regulars at these 5K races, and they know who's putting up good times and who's not putting up good times. And the way you get in that inner circle is by putting up good times. Like that's how you get on their radar of the top tier of whatever it is by showing that you can hang in that discussion. And I think as things pertain to specifically the Barkley marathons, I would imagine it is much like the next documentary, spoiler alert, that we're going to be talking about, so hopefully sometime very soon, SOM, which is about becoming a master sommelier. I would imagine it's much like that, where it is a virtually entirely binary thing. You are either someone who has or has not completed the Barkley marathons, and you are either someone who has or has not become a master sommelier.
I think that's a common thread that you see in any pursuit like that, where you can either be the type of person who naturally people respect and like and want to be around, or you can lack that but just have the raw skill and the raw knowledge and the achievements that you can point to and earn that respect. And so you often see a lot of these figures who maybe they're kind of a loner, or they kind of do their own thing. They're not maybe the most inviting to other people or the easiest to be around. But there's always this respect, and in some cases this awe from other members of that community, because they are just so good at what they do, and they're so talented and so driven that you want to be like them even if you don't like them, if that makes sense.
Right, and it seemed to me, honestly, like Jared, obviously Brett entered this race with that kind of reputation, but it seemed like, being someone who had done it successfully the year before, but it also seemed like Jared right away was flagged up as someone on that same level based on his results in other races, and we'll see him be the second place finisher here, and as I've mentioned a couple times, he will go on to now, at least at the time of this recording, have completed the Barkley Marathons 3 separate times, and we see him pop up in both of these documentaries, but certainly for someone who ended up finishing the race, it struck me as somewhat odd, at least, that they weren't doing more to get footage of Jared and interviews with Jared. Did that stand out as weird to you, or did you think that was understandable given the kind of parameters they had to work under and the kind of time restriction?
It didn't stand out so much because they weren't devoting that effort to anyone else instead, right? So if it was a documentary about Brett's quest to complete the Barkley Marathon again and cement his place in history, then it would make sense to not focus so much on Jared. But as it happens, they didn't really focus all that much on Brett either. Brett he's there, and they get footage of him, and they follow his journey throughout the race because he ends up winning, and so you have to capture that. But it doesn't feel like a documentary about Brett or about Jared or really about anyone in particular. So people just pop up when they're relevant to the narrative and then disappear again. And so in that sense, it's kind of lacking, actually. You don't come away really invested in any one person in particular, including Jared and John and Brett. So it stands out, but in a backdrop where the same treatment is being applied to everyone else, for better or for worse.
Well, I mean, we see, I think at pretty much every single interloopal period, we check in with both Brett and John and what they're doing at camp and what they're eating and so forth and how their feet are looking. And at no point, even as we lose the 90% of the field and it's down to just these three guys, we're still never checking in with what Jared has going on at his camp. And maybe he was saying, get out of here, I don't want to be part of the movie, I want to focus on this race, which would be totally fair and understandable on his end. But it did, for whatever reason, it just seemed like, I guess as a general proponent for a balanced edit, it stood out to me as very odd that Jared was getting so little compared to specifically Brett and John.
As someone who has seen this race, seen this documentary several times now, could you pick Jared out of a lineup? Like, could you?
Yes.
Okay, because I couldn't. I'm not sure that, like, he didn't make a strong impression. And part of that is, I think, that's his personality, right? He's fairly low-key. He's just out there doing his thing. But also, as you say, they just give no attention to Jared. And if we were to dive into the edit zone here, it seemed like there was basically no chance that, let's say, Jared would win the race and Brett would fail to finish.
Oh, I have some edit zone takes coming. Don't worry about the edit zone for this movie.
Let's do it. Let's get right in there.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say, before we get into the edit zone, because it reminded me, Jared, not only would I recognize his face, but he also has a distinct sounding voice. And speaking of, I guess, indistinct sounding voices. John, I didn't notice this until the most recent viewing of this documentary, but if you watch this again, you will for sure hear this. John sounds exactly like Max Dawson. He has the exact same intonation and a very similar voice to Max Dawson. It is absolutely creepy if you watch any John scenes with that in mind. But to get into the edit zone of all of this, I absolutely was watching this as someone who watches way too much reality TV. And in particular, as things pertain to Brett and John being the two, I thought, far more visible characters than anyone other than Lazarus, I thought it was essentially down to the two of them as for who was going to win this race. And even when we get to the fourth loop is over and Brett is back in the middle of the night and it's pitch dark and John doesn't get back until the next morning and he's like hours behind, I was still, the first time watching through this movie, saying to myself, something's about to go awry for Brett, because I really felt like every time we cut back to Brett at camp, it was shots of him telling his wife, no, I don't want that. No, I'm good. I only need to spend 10 minutes here. I can go right back out. And I thought something was like medically going to go wrong for Brett.
So John became the Ken McNichol of the Barbie Marathon.
Absolutely. And by extension, because Jared was so invisible, I thought something would Jared get lost or something on that last loop. Like as they were all leaving on their fifth loop, even knowing John was many hours behind, I still thought he was the front runner. I guess pardon the pun about them literally running.
You're forgiven. But yeah, if Jared had just collapsed and died somewhere in lap five of the course, you wouldn't know anything about it, right? They don't put any effort into following his journey. So he is there. And so it feels less satisfying in a way, because when you get back to camp after lap four and you know that Brett and Jared have to part ways now because you have to go in opposite directions after the final lap. So there's no one person following the other or one person helping the other out. There's no sense of, okay, these are people on an equal playing field and either could win and it's going to be a race to the finish to see which one of them can get back there, first of all, but then get back there within the time limit and get back there ahead of the other one. You know that it's going to be Brett, right? And maybe there are going to be no winners this year. Maybe Brett's going to follow that final hurdle. But you know that if he does, it's not going to be Jared pipping him to the post anytime soon.
Right. And again, I was thinking they would both somehow not finish or get passed by John in some miracle world. Like that's how much of a puppet for a glowing edit I am after all of these years of Survivor.
Yeah, so you should have just had more faith in Brett, Colin. He hasn't failed at anything in his life before. He's not going to start now just to appease your pessimism.
Okay. What did you make, by the way, of that rule where you have to go alternate directions for the final lap? Because obviously I, Colin Stone, love the diabolical nature of that rule. What did you think of that, of having it be a race where you don't know how far along your opponent is? Is that good or bad for the race element?
I approve of the general principle of Lazarus fucking with people. I don't know if this is the best way to go about it, because you're weighing up these two competing interests. So on the one hand, you don't get the photo finish where one person's running into camp and you see the other one lagging behind them and desperately trying to catch up, but they see the other person getting into camp and they see their hopes dash before them. You don't get that at the very end. But that, I don't know how often that happens anyway.
Right. I think Lazarus would say, in order to have a photo finish, you need finishers.
Yeah, exactly. And on the other hand, I think it adds to the overall sense of disorientation and confusion. And you saw Brett say, like, he was confused because he didn't know when exactly he did pass Jared or he was expecting to pass Jared. And so he didn't know where he was in the race. And so you have this added sense of urgency that underlies everything. Because if you're running the same direction, if you haven't passed someone within a certain length of time, either they've got hopelessly lost and maybe you're still in with a chance. And that gives you this optimism. But by and large, if you haven't seen them and you feel yourself slacking and lagging behind, you know that it's over, right? You know that they're going to get there however many hours ahead of you, however many minutes, and you're drawing dead. Whereas this way, that could actually be the case, and you wouldn't be any the wiser. Like, you never know if you need to, like, slam your foot on the gas pedal and get there as fast as you can, because if you do, you'll get there within 1 minute of them, or if you're 2 hours ahead and you could take a nap and you'd win the race anyway. You just don't know. And I think that does add this fun element to it.
Right. I think the element of like partial information is really fun. And you hit the nail on the head. I think it adds a sense of urgency, right, when you're on the trail. And as far as you know, Jared may be blasting through going counterclockwise, so I can't take any breaks or slow down at all. I've got to go through and really push myself to the limit. And I think that's exactly in line with what Lazarus wants from people. And speaking of things of that nature, I thought a couple other kind of quirks to this race that were really fun and said a lot both about the race itself and about Lazarus and the kind of brain that he has. I loved the element that, first of all, the course map changes every year, and secondly, that there's just one map that you have to show up 12 hours ahead of time at least, but probably more than, probably a day ahead of time at like base camp, and mark your own map. There's going to be one that we just pass around, and it's just honor system. Everyone takes their turn, and get your compass out because you're going to need it, and get your rulers because, you know, Rat Jaw is not going to climb, you know, the path to Rat Jaw is not going to find itself. I thought that was really cool, that it really is like a true adventurism kind of element to it, combined with the fact that there are both day loops and night loops, I thought was really, really fascinating.
Yeah, it's not just a race, it's also an exercise in orienteering too. Right. So you could be this amazing distance runner, but if you can't find your bearings out there and hold those bearings throughout five laps in opposite directions at day and at night, then you're not going to complete the race. And I like that. I like that you have this holistic challenge almost, where I think that's where the mental part of it comes in too, where you see people who find themselves slowly getting driven insane out there and slowly losing their mind, and they can't even tell, like, am I meant to go left here or go right? Did I go past this bit already? Am I going in a circle? Do I recognize this bit from the first time I went through this course, but that was a day and this is at night, so it looks completely different? And it's so easy to get lost, not only in your own head, but just lost in general out there.
Right. I mean, we see in Where Dreams Go to Die that Gary, his second time around, I noticed several times both he and his wife commented about how much stronger his navigational skills had gotten. It seemed like after his first year, that was one of, at least, if not like literally his number one takeaway, was I can physically handle this. It is the navigational aspect that got the better of me.
And one part of that navigation, which I guess helped as a signpost, but it's also an added requirement that they have to meet, is at various points throughout the course, you have to tear off your own allotted page number in a book. And there are several books scattered throughout the course. And that's also a way to, I guess, let the runners know that they're on the right track, but also so that you know there's no course cutting. There's someone's not going to try and angle shoot or cheat the system by cutting off part of the course, because if you show up and you don't have your pages from every book on every lap, then you haven't finished the race. You have not officially completed the Barkley Marathons.
And there will not be wiggle room in terms of the time limit or the pages. You must be accounted for everything.
Absolutely not. If you are 6 seconds out, you are 6 seconds out. And that's just the way it is. And Lazarus, as always, likes to have his fun wherever he can. So you see the titles of the books are general commentaries on the people who run the race and the race itself. So you have The Idiot popping up this year, and just general poking fun at that. But you also have these perfectly tailored attacks on individual runners, just poking fun at their past failures and needling them as they go throughout the race. So if you have failed the race in humiliating fashion, Lazarus will conveniently find a book whose title could be construed as a reference to that somehow.
Yeah, really, really strong stuff from Lazarus. And one other thing that I forgot to mention, but is another quirk of the race that I think is genius, and I'm hoping to find a way to incorporate something like this into my own personal life. Perhaps when it comes to scheduling podcasts, he just gives a 12-hour window of when this race is going to start. He says it's going to start sometime between midnight and noon, and I'll blow the conch shell to let you know when you have an hour before it starts.
And that could be at 1 in the morning. It could be really whenever you like. Yeah.
Hypothetically, yeah. And this year, the race is going to start at 8:11 to be precise in the morning. And what actually, kind of speaking of time, one element I thought was interesting and I guess kind of slightly unfair in the sense that I can't imagine many races do this, but up until I think it was 2016, the first year of Where Dreams Go to Die, they didn't allow watches out on the course. And then in 2016, Lazarus gave people watches synced up to Barkley time. So they only knew how long they'd been out on the course and not like the actual time of day or anything. I guess they could do the math. But what did you think of that, of the element of, is that just more disorientation as far as you're concerned? Or was there anything more significant, or did you read into that at all?
It feels like more of the same, but I wonder if there's a point where it does go too far and it becomes, it's not an interesting challenge. It's just a hassle, right? It's one more thing that you have to suffer without or to worry about.
Yeah, to me it seemed like, given that there are certain checkpoints, like if you're not back after, I think it's like 12 hours, you can't start on the second loop, and then 24 hours, you can't start on the third loop. I would be in Lazarus's shoes, you know, just given the sheer insanity of this race, I would hope for more people to at least be out there attempting the next loop, even knowing that they're probably not going to make it to the end.
You do see people gaming the system in some ways there. Like there was one guy that I think Gary mentioned who he knew he needed to start the next lap within a certain period of time. So he jogged 20 feet into the course and then just took a nap for the next few hours, because that's, yeah, he met the requirements, but he also knew he couldn't go on in his current state. So that's the way he squared that circle.
That's smart, because you take your next page number, you're no longer allowed to get any kind of help at camp. So just get all of your food and stuff ready and grab your bib and just take a nap right on the other side of the gate. That's genius.
Yeah, but the lack of watches, it might be the same thing as sending the final lap runners in the opposite directions, where if you don't know what the state of play is, then you have to go quickly, because the worst thing that you can do is to get complacent and be capable of finishing the lap or finishing the race and lose because of your own stupidity,
right?
And that's almost a worse way to go out than to go to your limits, find that you can't do it, and bow out gracefully with tabs in the background, knowing that you did everything you could.
Right. I think the idea of this race is, one is required to constantly push oneself for 2.5 days straight, and that anything short of that is not going to get you through the Barkley marathons. And I think that's like the line that Laz is constantly trying to find, and that's why he makes it harder every time someone finishes.
I don't know if there's any intention behind it, more so than just his latent sadism, but that interpretation works too. Sure.
Whatever works. Dom, I wanted to talk just quickly about a couple other characters that I really enjoyed from this race that we didn't see too much of, but I wanted to hear your take on, first of all, let's go with Frozen Ed, who was the first ever finisher of the Barkley Marathons back when it was only three loops, aka a fun run. That was all it took to finish the Barkley Marathons back during the early days, and he was the first one ever to do that, and he's still out there. He got through at least one lap and went back out for a second, if not a second into a third, but he ended up going out somewhere around the middle. This is the guy, for people who watched it more casually, he had the fantastic mustache and the stellar leggings. What did you think of Frozen Ed, Dom?
I love Frozen Ed, and you know that for a lot of these people, their part in the documentary is purely instrumental. It's the Barkley Marathons. 90% of people who turn up are going to fail it. And 90% of the people who run it in the documentary, you know, have to fail it to convey the gravity of how difficult this is. Because you know, if everybody that the show highlighted or focused on made it to the end and just effortlessly sauntered to the finish line, then it wouldn't be the race that eats its young, as the subtitle says. So, you know, most of the people you see are going to fail. They are the human sacrifices for the documentary. And so I like it when, you know, you're not going to spend too much time with them, but the time you have is fun. And Frozen Ed definitely clears that bar.
Yeah, I thought we were done with Frozen Ed until I believe he was the one who showed up to pop that giant blister off of whichever of Brett or John it was. I think it was John, before his fifth lap, talked about how it was great having such a knowledgeable kind of like team of people supporting him and helping him get ready to get back out there. And Frozen Ed was heroically lancing that like 2-inch diameter blister.
Brett just had this medicine ball attached to his foot, and it really helps to have friends who are happy to go through the work of popping that for you.
That's right. And the other person I wanted to flag up that I really loved was Wouter, who was, I think, one of the German runners. It seemed like there were a few of them. Certainly sounded German, and he made it, I think may have completed the fun run, but didn't go beyond that or came close to that. And he was a lot of fun. And much like the British guy, had a lot of poignant words about what a challenge it was.
Yeah, unlike most of the German runners, Wouter was actually from Belgium. But
fine.
But yeah, he was a really fun presence, and he had this deer in the headlights look about him. You could tell that. I mean, he'd done his homework. He was smart, but he knew that the odds were sad against him, and that maybe it wouldn't be this year. Maybe this was a dry run or hopefully a fun run as well for the next time around. But you knew that Wouter would be the plucky underdog who didn't quite make it, and sure enough, that's what he ended up as.
Yeah, and I also really liked the guy with the amazing flow, the long hair, Nick, who made it out along with Alan. They definitely made it through at least the fun run, and then I think had quit somewhere around like the halfway point of either the fourth. I think only the three guys left for the fifth lap, so Nick and Alan must have gone out during the fourth lap. And Nick in particular, I thought was interesting to note that while this one didn't go his way, Nick, who was only 21 years old at the time that this would film, would go on to the following year complete the Barkley Marathon. It shows a picture of him at the gate at the end of the movie when they show like the montage of all the people who have finished, but it doesn't specify, hey, by the way, this is Nick that you just saw a little bit of from this movie. I thought worth giving him his credit where it's due for the following year finishing this.
Yeah, a lot of documentaries like this, they make a point of tying up their loose ends in some kind of closing montage, or at least giving you a future update on how they did. So if there's a character who they know the audience will be rooting for, but they fall just short this time, it's always a nice note to end on to say, well, they came back the next year and they succeeded. There's nothing like that here. And it would almost go against the spirit of the documentary to do that. And in some cases, that's because it's not possible, because they did come back next year and they failed again and again and again. And again, and that's, maybe they should have ended on that. They should have said, okay, Gary came back for the next 4 years and still failed to finish. So that would be a nice thing to flash on the screen there at the end.
I wonder who has the record for most attempts without finishing. Someone's got to have tried it. Probably Frozen Ed has done it without going five loops more than anyone else.
And there's no shame in failing, right? There's for something that's difficult, and just in general, you know, if you show up, you do your best, you're realistic about your goals and your expectations and your capabilities, there's no shame in failing something like that. It's not like anyone's life is on the line here, except the people who run the race, who could die at any moment, it seems like. Yeah. But this is a personal challenge and a personal quest, and for some people it takes longer than others, or it looks different than other people's quests, and that's totally okay.
So right around this point, she completes the fun run, but ends up calling it there and not wanting to go out for a fourth lap, and understandable at that point. There was an older woman named Bev who made it real deep into this race. I want to set the line on her occupation at over-under district attorney for Bev, making it through three laps. I feel like she's got to have an insane amount of political power.
She must have had some illustrious career, but she could also be one of these like para grannies you hear about who in their old age decide to just take up some extreme sport or something and obviously end up crushing it with their usual aplomb.
Mm-hmm. It remains to be seen, but I would not be shocked at all if Bev has some major influence in whatever area she's from. So let's, I guess, get into the lead in to the final loop, where we at this point have lost everyone other than Brett and John and Jared. And Brett and Jared are about to head out for their last lap. And Brett, this contributed more to the kind of loser edit that I was talking about. Brett's talking about at his camp, like, oh man, I had to hang back and wait for Jared at so many points during that fourth loop. I really helped him get through there. I don't know if he would have made it without me. I hope this doesn't come back to haunt me. And this is exactly what I was talking about in terms of just completely taking the bait for Brett somehow having this turned around on him.
Yeah, so what were you expecting when you saw that? Because I know you were intently reading the edit. I'm sure you had your edit chart all nicely highlighted and colored. So were you expecting this was the moment that things were finally going to turn sour for Brett? Or what were you thinking there?
So at this point, what I kept picking up on, it was not as overt in the earlier interloopal periods, but it really seemed like in that time between the fourth and fifth loop, Brett's wife was constantly offering him food and he just kept saying no. And at this point, I was waiting for Brett to somehow just collapse of malnutrition. That's what I thought. That's truthfully what I thought was going to happen to Brett.
Yeah, that's one thing that stands out about the everyone who was featured in the documentary. There's no sense of hubris, right? You don't have some like bragger who comes in thinking, oh, this will be a breeze. I've done so many races like this before. All right, I've done this in the past and I've succeeded, so surely I can do it again. And then they end up making that out of themselves. Everyone seems either humble or they never get to that stage in the first place. And I think that's what the race does to you, right? Like, it's very hard to remain arrogant in the face of your obvious impending, at least challenge, but probable failure as well.
Yeah. I guess actually I have in my notes here that Nick and Alan did both make it out for at least a portion of the fourth loop. So don't want to sell them short at all. And on this fifth loop, I did think the documentary did a really good job of setting up that race that we kind of touched on earlier between Brett and Jared. Now, as they head out for this fifth loop, they have to go in opposite directions. And while Jared was getting such an invisible edit, I still probably would have said I would take Jared over Brett to win this race entering, like as I was watching it for the first time, as they were departing for the fifth loop. Like, that's how much of a sicko I am about people getting what I thought was like manipulated negative kind of content in the form of Brett not wanting any of the food all the time.
You can never just go back now to sitting back and watching a documentary and not trying to analyze it, not trying to read between the lines and figure out who's going to win based on some lapse in concentration by the editors. You can't just be a casual anymore.
Well, what were you thinking the first time that you watched it?
I was thinking, oh, wow, this race looks scary and, oh, this is really tense and suspenseful. I was the credulous buffoon that, you know, the rest of the audience is and that you always look down on.
For whom were you rooting?
All of them. They all seem like perfectly nice individuals. I don't know.
That is the opposite of the Lazarus answer. You need to be rooting for none of them.
Well, I'm not Lazarus, Colin. I'm not you, okay? I'm cut from a different cloth.
All right. It's not dumb, but don't root against them for you, for your own sickness. Root against them for them so that they feel the true reward when it actually ends up working out. That's the whole point of this thing.
Fair enough.
It's all just altruistic, Dom.
I'll take your word for it.
Okay. You should. And so I guess let's go through this fifth loop, excuse me. There's not a ton of fanfare as pretty quickly Brett ends up being the first place finisher. And I wonder how much of that had to do with just kind of in general, Lazarus, I believe, not loving having cameras out there on the course. I know for Where Dreams Go to Die, they were only allowed to film in a few kind of specific locations. And certainly almost nowhere out on the course itself. And there were plenty of shots from the race, specifically like near the prison. I know they got a lot of really visually compelling footage. But I was kind of surprised at, other than like seeing them go through like the briars on Ratjaw, just how little of the race itself we actually end up getting to see in specifically in this final loop, as it's such a tight race between Brett and Jared, just how quickly we cut to the part between, well, they're off and Brett's back.
Yeah, I wonder if in one sense Lazarus might have been reluctant to have the documentary take place. Not because he's camera shy or anything. I'm sure he loves giving the Lazarus-like experience to a wider audience, but just showing what the race is and highlighting it removes some of that air of mystery. But I guess at the same time, you are generating this whole buzz around it. And it still remains exclusive. You still have to jump through all of these hoops to get in. Only the same number of people are going through that every year. But now when they do, many people are following along at home with interest. And so this whole mythology that Lazarus has built up around it feels that much more important, I guess.
I wonder if Lazarus was mad that the 1 year they made this giant documentary about how insane this race is, an all-time record number of people end up finishing the race.
Right. Yeah, so it might not have been best for the documentary itself, but for him in the documentary, it would have been best if Brett just collapses and needs to be medevaced on the fifth lap, and Jared gets lost somewhere, ends up going in a circle, goes over the time limit. Like, you really want people to fail in a lot of humiliating ways, but sadly for him, but luckily for the rest of us, a large contingent comes through this time.
Well, to start to tie in a little more from Where Dreams Go to Die, I really think Lazarus took a lot of pleasure in having, even though he came up, you know, from the wrong direction, I think he loves the storyline of someone coming up 6 seconds short of finishing the Barkley marathons. Like as Gary is crossing the line and people are like, oh my God, what was his time? Lazarus is so quick to say, nope, it crossed 60. I was watching.
He was grinning like a Cheshire cat. He was loving it. He was loving every one of those 6 seconds that elapsed over the time limit. And it is worth noting that in that case, because he came from the wrong direction, it would have been null and void anyway, even if he was 10 seconds faster. But despite that, I'm sure Lazarus took pride in that storyline. And sure enough, next year, one of the books was called 6 Seconds, in a real fuck you to Gary Robbins in particular.
Yeah. So I guess let's get into...
I would also say, just on the prison quickly, I love that... You really have to navigate your way carefully through this course. And at most points, the penalty is, well, you're going to lose some time and get disoriented and maybe get cut up by those bramble thickets a little bit. If you wander off the reservation near the prison, they have a shoot-to-kill policy. So you've got to be really careful that that you're staying on the actual course there. Although Lazarus is not going to help you mark it. That you're going to have to put the work in there yourself.
Yeah. So we see Brett end up finishing, and that's a great moment for him and his family. He sets the new all-time course record by about 3 hours, I believe. And I think that is, as mentioned the last time, Brett probably wanted to run the Barkley marathons. Jared is our second place finisher, and I don't know if he was the first place finisher the second time that he ran it, but he certainly was the first place finisher the third time that he ran it, which we got to see in Where Dreams Go to Die, and has completed the Barkley marathons 3 times now. And it still remains weird to me that, I guess statistically, like, the GOAT of the Barkley marathons is just kind of a super background character in the two documentaries about this race.
Right. And I guess there's a sense of handing over the baton to a new generation and watching them try and succeed and try and break that record. But maybe it's fitting as well that the actual GOAT, the one person who has been able to master and conquer this race, is in the background and remains a mystery himself, and you don't really get to know about it.
That's good spin zone there, Dom. And then with 18 minutes left to spare, our hero John ends up crossing the finish line in the pitch black and gets to hit the staples button, which, by the way, is a fantastic kind of way to end the race. You get through your 130 miles, your 2.5 days of no sleep and constantly on the move, and you get to hit the staples that was easy button, which I really love.
It's really good, yeah. And it's worth noting too that this documentary, it's no great cinematic masterpiece, right? I don't think the production quality is anything to write home about. It does feel, and look, they do good work for sure, and it's well put together. So Som, for instance, which you mentioned is the next one that we plan to talk about, it's clear that a lot of care went into that, and that part of the appeal of the documentary is the way that it's put together and just the visuals of it and the whole aesthetic around it. With the Barkley Marathons, it almost feels like the lack of any care there is appropriate. It is what you'd expect from a documentary about this race in particular, right? Where it is kind of on this shoestring budget, and you don't want Lazarus Lake in high definition. It feels almost inappropriate to render him that way. It's better if he just pops into this grainy shot from time to time, spouts some words of wisdom, and then just abruptly vanishes again.
Right. You certainly, I think, get the sense that the filmmakers too are just setting up their own tent and eating off their own heat plate and eating their own bananas and beans and granola bars and so forth. And I feel like that does come through, and the movie really benefits from that for sure.
I will say though, so I bring this up to say that the one shot that I really did like and thought was stunning visually was when they get near the prison, there's this underwater tunnel, I guess, that they have to run through, where the stream or something goes underneath, and that's where it intersects with the track. And as John is talking about the personal challenges that inspired him to take on this new personal challenge in running the race, he kind of like lies on his back in the water as the stream flows over him, and because it's the tunnel, it's casting the shadow and it's dark, but you see the light coming out from one end, like illuminating him, and it looks so stunning visually. And I and the whole package there, like that shot and what he's talking about at the time. And by that point, you're rooting for John to finally go and finish just in time. That all comes together so perfectly.
Yeah, Dominic, you don't know this, but, well, you'll know the first part of this, which is for every podcast, we put a picture up with the blog post, so there's some kind of image with it. And I promise you, long before you made that statement, that was going to be the blog picture for this episode, is John lying there in that. When I saw that for the second time, I knew, you know, the first time knowing I was going to podcast about this movie, I said, that's it. That's the one.
Wonderful. To be fair, there are lots of good candidates in this movie. You could just have a generic shot of Lazarus's toothy grin. You could just have the "that was easy" button. There are just so many good things, but that to me is the most like enduring shot of the whole movie.
The gas tank on E would also be pretty fitting too. People getting by just with barely anything left in the tank, I think, is a nice metaphor for this whole picture.
Yeah, we could have Brett's gigantic blister being popped. lots of ways you could go there.
Yeah. So there we have it, Dom. We have three finishers of the Barkley Marathons, John just under the wire. And I swear, the first time I watched this movie, part of me thought to myself, maybe they kind of stretched that window out a little bit to make him come in under the time limit so that the movie can end a bit more happily. And then I saw Where Dreams Go to Die and the pleasure that Lazarus took in that 6-second cushion, and I immediately ruled that premise out. There is no chance Laz would allow that.
Say what you will about Lazarus, but he stays on theme. There's no stretching the premise for the sake of the documentary.
Yeah, although in terms of stretching the premise, I did love that the very closing thing in the documentary is them asking Lazarus, "So have you ever finished the Barkley?" "No, not even close."
Why would he?
Like, so all that talk about how you could do 100 miles out there is such a perfect way of ending.
Yeah, and I just want more Lazarus Lake content in my life. If we can get him in here for an interview, that would be the ultimate get in my eyes.
I would 100% be down. If anyone out there knows Lazarus or lives in Tennessee and can go get a hold of him for us, free patron for life as far as I'm concerned. So, Dom, one thing I wanted to bring up from this movie is the way that this will sound weird and sappy or whatever, but this has genuinely had a real life impact on me, having seen this movie ever since the first time I watched it. Like the following day, I don't remember what was going on, but very shortly after seeing this movie for the first time, I had like a 9-hour drive or something, and I mentally decided to like split it up into 2-hour loops and just think of it in terms of loops. And and I genuinely have at so many points in my life, obviously driving is not that hard. I'm not trying to say that driving is like running the Barkley Marathons, Dom. But anytime that I'm
it's like Bojack Star. Driving is your Vietnam. Right?
Anytime that I'm doing something that I feel like is going to be in any way kind of trying for me, I mentally have gotten into the habit of splitting it into loops, and in doing so, am then constantly thinking to myself about this movie and about people, particularly like John, about how hard he pushed himself, and constantly finding myself saying, whatever the task is that I don't want to be in the middle of doing, for instance, podcasting with a rude British person, I split it into loops, and I am constantly thinking to myself about how if John could get back out there after 2 days of no food and no sleep and run yet another marathon, of course I can get through 1/5 of whatever this task is. And I'm not even kidding when I say I have that thought at least a few times a month. I think about this movie in those terms.
Well, you have come back out on this loop literally hundreds of times now, so we can all applaud you for that. But
right.
I thought the way you were setting it up, it was, I watched this documentary, and the next day I went up and I hired a trainer and I signed up for this gym membership, and I began this whole story of personal transformation. I wasn't expecting, now I think about everything in terms of loops.
I do.
Sure. I can't get myself in that mindset, but I believe you that was profound.
Well, not only is the loop kind of splitting technique effective in chunking out smaller sections of difficult, larger tasks that are much more easy or much easier to manage, but again, it also, in thinking about it in those terms, is constantly reminding me of this movie and the motivation that all of these people were able to find even to be out there in the first place. And to you know, for someone like me who is not often in situations where that kind of effort is, or anything close to that, is required, it really is a successful motivator to me to think about just what these people put themselves through and how easy whatever it is I'm doing is by comparison.
If you end up bailing halfway through, do you tell yourself, well, at least I completed a fun run? Do you, when you do quit, is Taps playing your head in the background? Like, have you really taken the whole thing on?
I have certainly thought of many things in terms of just being a fun run. Like, for instance, we, after the last season of Survivor, got in touch with Dominic Abate, and he was down to do an interview. And I had an inkling that that was going to go pretty long. And it ended up going 4 hours. And I remember thinking at like the 3.5 hour mark, that's about a fun run for a Dom and Colin podcast. Like, it seems insane, I would say, for most other podcasters. But when you frame it in terms of 3.5 hours just being a fun run, it's not that bad when you go four or more.
Is there a larger metaphor here? Like, is God Lazarus Lake? Does he have that kind of twisted sense of humor?
I mean, if the current just earthly landscape is any indication, then absolutely, Dom. I think there's no doubt about it.
That's the way I'm leaning too. Yeah.
All right. So I guess let's kind of close on the Barkley Marathon specifically before just a couple of other things I think to flag up from Where Dreams Go to Die. But I want to ask you, Dom, I know we're both big fans of documentaries and we've covered other documentaries, and I'm curious how this one kind of stacks up for you. So I will ask you to evaluate the Barkley Marathon on a scale of 1 to 10 Staples buttons.
I'm a big fan of this documentary, and if I had to rank my favorites by the number of times that I've seen them, this would be near the top of the list, and I couldn't really articulate why. I guess part of it is that with some of them, the journey itself or the final outcome is what keeps it entertaining. So if the draw to this documentary was you follow Brett on his journey and it's up in the air whether he's going to finish or not, and then it comes close, it's tight, but just at the end, he scrapes over the finish line. That would be great the first time you saw it, and then on further viewings, well, it would lack the same luster because you've seen it before, you know what's happening. But to me, I don't know if it's a sign of them not making the outcome itself compelling, or the fact that it's strong enough otherwise that doesn't really come into play. So I can watch it several times and still be entertained by just Lazarus in general, or be in awe at just how brutal the race looks, even though I've seen it many times before and it's become somewhat normalized to me. It's not resting on any suspense over what is actually going to happen here at the end.
So how many Staples buttons?
What kind of scale are we using here?
1 to 10 Staples buttons.
I'd give it a solid 8.5 Staples buttons.
Wow, okay. So very solid score there from Dom. Not a surprise. I mean, I sound, I suppose, more surprised than I actually am. I just am used to Dom giving something what sounds like praise, and then when it comes time to actually judge it, it turns out he's not actually that into it. But a very, very respectable 8.5 there from Dom. A tough man to please. I'm totally with you. This is a documentary I've seen many times myself, and I'm sure I will watch again in the future, because this is one that I like to show to other people. I think I take pride in being the person who introduces people to what the Barkley Marathons are and this movie in general. And I'm not going to go as high as 8.5, just because I do think, compared to when I'm thinking about just the grand scheme of documentaries, as phenomenal as Lazarus himself is, I don't know that the kind of the bench of characters is as deep as you're going to get a lot of other places, but certainly still a ton of awesome stuff going on here in this. And I was going to give it 8 Staples That Was Easy buttons. A very big fan of the Barkley Marathons, and I would certainly be interested in seeing a follow-up if indeed, as I suspect, this race has probably gotten a bit harder now that Lazarus has seen, so relatively speaking, so many people finish in these subsequent years. I think I would absolutely be here for some sort of follow-up if that would be something that you think would even be captivating, Dom. Do you think this that a follow-up that would be more about now more people finding out about this race and people like the Gary Robbinses of the world going so far out of their way to be there? Because I would imagine the landscape has shifted a bit, but does it potentially lose its impact if the idea of the Barkley Marathons is something we're already very familiar with?
I think it's certainly ripe for a follow-up. I guess the larger question, though, is has it sparked an interest in the ultra running community in general for you? So this race in particular has all of these quirks to it, but if there was a documentary about some other race or just about runners or running, would that would you be more likely to sign up for that now than you were in the past?
Yes. Now, having seen the Barkley marathons, I would be more interested in checking out a random documentary about ultra marathoners than I would have otherwise been. But I would also say, I think any such documentary I would probably find not as interesting as the Barkley marathons, unless the race itself were more intense than the Barkley marathons are. Like, for instance, if we were to just have a flat road 100-mile race starring a bunch of more interesting characters, I think that would be really fascinating. But I would still say the Barkley marathons itself like would be the ultimate star of any kind of race that any kind of racing movie could hope to have, and I don't know how well another kind of ultra marathon documentary would necessarily stack up for me, just given how much I enjoy the uniqueness of the Barkley marathons.
So you're too good for them now? You need ultra marathons to whet your appetite?
I think I have the kind of Brett mentality, I guess, when it comes to documentaries about marathons, which is if it's not the most intense marathon in the world, it's not enough for me.
Yeah, with all of this genre of documentary, you get the sense that they need to be focusing on the best in the world. It has to be the national champion or the world champion or people who are really at the top of their game, and following people who are just there for the ride, and they have a go, they make a good effort, but they, you know, it really has to focus on the top. And if you don't, then I think that can still work and it can still be interesting, but your entire approach to that documentary has to be different, because that one unifying theme is the pursuit of excellence. And if it's the pursuit of excellence but probably being mediocre and being okay with that on some level, then that doesn't quite have the same ring to it.
Well, think about the documentaries that we've covered to this point and the next one that we're going to do. We've done The King of Kong, this one, AlphaGo, and then coming up soon is going to be Somme. And every single one of them is about people competing at the highest level of whatever they are pursuing.
And to build on that running question, would you have more of an interest in other, let's say, extreme sports documentaries now, or anything in that general oeuvre, I guess?
Yeah, probably. I mean, that's something that I've always been interested in, sports documentaries and extreme sports. I don't think would have been an exception. I just haven't encountered a ton of documentaries that seemed super appealing from that realm. But yeah, I would say, having seen this, I would be more open in general to watching something about people going on like the most intense kayaking trip or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know how well they would lend themselves to a podcast about them. Maybe this is my inbuilt biases coming through here. But to me, if I see something like that, I can think, oh, wow, she runs really fast. But I can't give any like more educated or informed or detailed analysis of that. It really speaks for itself. And I think that's part of what the appeal of something like that is, that you can watch it and you don't need to think about it. You can just admire it for what it is and be in awe of it. But it does mean that for us, as we're doing our jobs here, there's, you know, if you find yourself casting around for something to say about it, then for us, that's not a great spot to be in.
Well, I think that's just the reality of like running. Like, I remember seeing James Lim, a friend of the podcast, James Lim, tweet once about how, you know, he's a big time runner. He ran at Harvard, and he feels that just one human running against the clock is like as pure as sports get in some sense. And I could certainly see an argument for that kind of idea.
Yeah, it is intensely personal, right? And what he said there, that applies to someone who just signed up for their first gym membership and they're slowly getting acquainted with the treadmill or whatever. That has this personal significance that means the world to them and doesn't have to, and it most likely doesn't actually mean anything to anyone else, and that's okay.
Yeah. So there we go with the Barkley marathons. A couple things from Where Dreams Go to Die that I wanted to bring up, which was the Gary Robbins and his personal journey through attempting the Barkley marathon. I thought, I guess let's quickly start with something you flagged up earlier, but it would be worth diving into here, is the difference between the Barkley Marathons tracking a bunch of people and more focusing on the race itself versus Gary, an individual, attempting this and tracking his journey. What did you think about the differences in the presentation here?
Yeah, so in the first documentary, in the Barkley Marathons, it's about the race itself. And as we said, the actual runners felt rather secondary at times. In this case, it's about Gary and Gary's exploits. And I imagine if you're one of Gary's subscribers and you've heard all the buzz around this documentary and about his journey and you're excited to follow him, it doesn't matter so much that it is the Barkley. It could be any other of these ultra insane races that that go on. And so for us as people who know nothing about either Gary himself or the races he's running, I'm okay with that. For me, I'm a blank slate, so I can appreciate it from both angles. But I imagine if you're someone who, you know, if you're one of Gary's fans for a long time, that's your preferred focus. Or if you're someone who really cares about the sport of running, maybe that's your, the first one appeals more to you instead.
Right. For me, I thought Gary was certainly an appealing kind of protagonist, and I got it pretty quickly. Like, okay, this guy's very committed to running and his beard and his wife. I get it that, this is what consumes his life at this point. And I thought he did a really good job kind of carrying the movie without trying to carry a movie. I think it was genuinely him documenting what was an organically just captivating experience, being someone going in with that kind of resume and having such wildly high expectations for himself. Like, the thing that I think stood out so much about Gary, and I'm sure this is exactly what we would have seen out of Brett his first time at the Barkley Marathons, is we talked about how so many people go in saying just doing one loop would be like a dream come true, or completing the fun run would be checking a major life goal off the bucket list. It is very clear from Gary's first attempt, anything short of completing this is the same, as he puts it, that's just a DNF, a did not finish. It's getting 4.99 loops is exactly the same in his mind as getting 0.1 loops. And I think that translates, and that is a big piece of what carries this movie versus someone going out there hoping to do well, but knowing it's probably not going to go their way.
And of the few other characters that feature in Gary's story, the ones that are obviously most prominent are his wife and his family. And so his wife is an interesting figure in this story, because you can tell both in what she says and just how she carries herself, she would rather be anywhere else in one sense. But on the other hand, she is devoted to Gary, and she knows how much this means to him, and she wants him to achieve this goal, even if she couldn't and doesn't really understand what this means to him. And that's not like a lack of empathy on her part. I don't think anyone who isn't involved in this just bizarre scene can really understand what it involves or what it means to the people taking part.
Right. I think there's virtually nothing that anyone who is not running these races themselves could do to get into the kind of mindset that it is required to face the Barkley Marathons. And I say that fully aware of the fact that his wife is like an ultra marathon runner herself. Like, if anyone could, I'm sure it would be other people who go through similar things. But this clearly, it seems, is a whole different kind of beast. But with that in mind, I would have said, had you not told me that people were coming away from this movie with kind of mixed reviews about his wife, I would have said she would be like one of the most popular characters on like the message boards about this movie. I thought she was like relentless in her willingness and enthusiasm to aid every single thing he asked of her along the way. Especially, I'm sure it was not limited just to his interlupal times. I'm sure for months and months leading up to both of these events, her entire life was affected deeply by him just preparing for this. So I would have said certainly that she was tremendously like resilient. And I would imagine, I know he ran again in 2018, and update on that, I read like a blog post he wrote about it, that he got like lost or something on his third loop. He got way delayed and eventually realized he just wasn't going to make it back in time to get going on the fourth loop. So as of 2018, as of the time of this recording, he is still, as far as I know, pursuing it. And I would imagine we'll be back out there next year. And I'm guessing that is not continuing to be easy on his wife. And I got very much Steve Wiebe's wife kind of vibes.
Yes.
That you described it well, of like she would probably rather be anywhere else in the world. Maybe not, because she is also, unlike, you know, Steve Wiebe's wife is not also a competitive video game player, I would assume. So maybe she is more into this kind of scene than the average runner's wife would be. But at the same time, it's certainly a tremendous burden upon her, and I don't even think it's borderline unfair. I think it is like insane what is asked of the people who need to pick up the pieces of those who are pursuing these like world-class endeavors.
And that's something that is missing, and it's not something that needs to be there necessarily, but you do notice that inevitably, if the focus is more on one man, then the focus by extension will be on his family and the toll that this sport, this crazy pursuit takes on your relationships as well. Whereas in Barkley, that was kind of lacking. So some of them just turn up solo. They've had to fly in from elsewhere, and obviously they're not going to bring their wife and their kids with them if they have them. So even the ones who do have their family there, they're supportive. And so when Brett comes in for his brief pit stop, everyone swarms in around him, and his wife is like feeding him up, and they're all fully supportive. You never really get a sense of what's going on behind the scenes, like how supportive they really are of this entire endeavor, what kind of strain it's placing on their marriage and so on. And you could say that would detract from the focus of the movie, which is the race and it being run. But at the same time, it's nice to have that look inside what this pursuit of excellence actually does, and the dark side of that, almost.
Oh, I would love the footage of Brett's wife after he has completed the Barkley Marathon in 2011 and accomplished this insane life goal, and then he breaks the news to her, yeah, I'm going to go do that again. I would love to see that kind of reaction, and I would imagine that, you know, to go back to what you were talking about, I'm guessing, you know, now that Gary has, for the third time in a row, it sounds like, tried and failed at the Barkley Marathons, I doubt he himself is like giving up on the idea, although maybe he has at this point. Maybe he's willing to just have taps played for him for the rest of his life. But I would guess that how many years can he really keep going, essentially, before his wife says, maybe we need to focus on other things?
And if they do end up having that conversation, what does he say? Because at this point, running is who he is. It's certainly how the public knows him. That's his public persona and how he's known to the world. And I imagine he has a lot of fans for whom that's the only role he plays in their lives, right? And this is the kind of parasocial relationship thing that we've spoken about in other contexts in the past. Like if there are people out there who know you as a runner, well, there are many more facets to your personality into who you are. But if that's the only way they know you, then it's easy for everything to get filtered through that prism. And so you see this come up a lot, for instance, when people talk about politics. Like some athlete will tweet about some injustice going on in the world, and inevitably their replies will get filled by people saying, well, stick to sports, or what are you talking about, or stay in your lane, as if they are just like this singular aspect and there's nothing else to them. So for his own part, like this is his identity. He is a runner. This is who he is. This is how he spends his time. This is what he's chosen to do, how he makes a living, as far as I can tell. So when that conversation inevitably has to happen of like, maybe we should be dialing this back, that's going to be hard for him, even if he's approaching it with a healthy attitude.
Are there professional runners? Are there just like ultra marathoners who that's what they do?
I imagine so. I don't know if there's some sponsorship involved or what the economics of all of that are, but I have to imagine there are people who this is their thing. Like this is how they sustain themselves.
Right. But there are certain sports where like, it doesn't matter if you're literally the best in the world, you can't make a living. Like there is no, maybe there is like, is there professional like curling or something like that? Like, I feel like most Olympians can't make a living at whatever. There's no professional like luge league, right? No one's making a living doing this.
Maybe there is. I don't know.
Is there is there even professional swimming?
Yes, obviously.
Obviously what? Name one professional swimmer not named Michael Phelps who you only know from the Olympics.
Pass.
Okay. I feel like that's all.
No. I got it. Okay. Shane Gould.
I knew you were going to say that. Whom you also know from the Olympics, and more accurately, whom you also only know from Australian Survivor.
She's finding other ways to make her dollars nowadays. So it's all right.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you then, Dom. 0-3 at this point for Gary Robbins here. I'm guessing maybe he clarified this in the blog, but it was quite long and I didn't read the entire thing. I more like skimmed it. Although incidentally, not a surprise at all, given what we've already talked about. Gary Robbins, stellar writer, extremely talented writer. Not a shock given, the education and so forth that we've already talked about in these ultra marathoners. But now having tried and failed three times, Dominic, over under 0.5 career finishes of the Barkley marathons for Gary Robbins.
I will say under because I believe he is on hiatus from the Barkley marathons. He is tapped out or taps out, if you rather, and he is moving on to not even bigger and better things, but just different things at this point.
Wow.
Because it was taking a physical strain and also maybe a personal strain as well. But I love how you make it sound that just the act of reading is somehow more strenuous than running an ultra marathon would be for you.
Look, I Googled to find out how he did in 2018, like 15 minutes before we started podcasting. I literally didn't have time to read the entire article. I just needed the result.
That's why, knowing that we were going to do this days in advance, we put this off several times by now. At some point in there, more than 15 minutes before the start, you know, we could do our homework and figure it out. But
you, okay, as usual, you could have done this too. Although I guess in this case, it sounds like
I literally did. But
okay, fair.
Leaving that aside.
All right. Well, I'm glad that you gave that kind of reasoning because I would have said over if he had continued sticking with it. He just seems too insanely physically capable, and with experience, I would imagine he would eventually have been able to do it. Although it also wouldn't shock me if Lazarus knew this guy was going to keep coming back. He just made the race impossible to make sure he never did it.
One thing I've always wondered about these professional runners or anyone who competes in sport at a high level is just that process of realizing eventually I physically cannot do this anymore. Like I want to keep doing this, but my knees do not want to keep doing this. And just how they come to terms with that. And I guess for some people, they keep going past the point where it is viable anymore. And they keep trying to relive that 15 minutes of fame. And, you know, just what that realization looks like of knowing that your career, the thing that you've taken so much pleasure and success in over the years is no longer on the table for you.
I mean, I think that's a major element in sports where people do get paid and make incredible livings is that knowledge that by the time, pretty much regardless of what sport you're in, for a solid 95% of players who were ever able to make a career out of it, you know, from age like 21, I have about a decade, if I'm lucky, to make a lifetime's worth of money.
It's always struck me as weird how you have a lot of tennis players, for instance, who no one who doesn't avidly follow tennis has ever heard of or would ever have cause to have heard of, but who are making a living by showing up to tournaments and getting these winnings. And I imagine there's sponsorship and coaching on the side and other things they do to sustain themselves. But it must be this almost solitary existence, almost, where you're kind of plugging away at this thing in relative obscurity for years outside of your own scene. And then at some point, you realize you have to go on to other things. And like, what do you do at that point when you're 35 and this is what you've been doing the whole time? Do you continue coaching and try and stay in that orbit, or do you just retrain as an accountant or something? Do you something completely different?
I think a lot of people would choose to get into coaching or whatever, but like we see, Brad Culpepper, for instance, plays many years, I think, in the NFL, but is now a lawyer because I'm sure he made a decent enough amount of money, but it's not like an insane amount of money. And Brad Culpepper had an easily above average NFL career compared to the number of people that come and go in the NFL. And
likewise, Debbie Branner was also an elite athlete, and she's done many other things with her time since then as well. So clearly it is possible to reinvent yourself like that.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think like in any of those worlds, though, while you do know that you're like up against the clock and you may not know what is necessarily coming next, I do think there is still the element of not really being super concerned for most people or not feeling weird about that in the moment, because to get to that level, specifically in sports, you spend your entire life since further back than you can remember playing whatever that sport is. Tiger Woods was swinging golf clubs from before the time he has any coherent memories of. Every single Olympic figure skater could skate before they walk or whatever. Like, that is your entire life pretty much until you are done. And at that point, I think it gets very weird. But I don't know if it even really sinks in, or if anyone on that level could even let it sink in before the time really comes.
Yeah, and I almost count myself lucky that I will never have to do that myself, right? I guess eventually maybe my British accent will start to fade, or, you know, I will have to stop doing this thing that I love. But for now, you know, it's all looking peachy.
All right, well, don't stay in Canada for that long. We need the accent to stay, because I feel like still, even after 7 full years, that's our number one draw is Dom's British accent.
That really is my moneymaker over here.
Yeah, so... Gary Robbins, Where Dreams Go to Die, quite a fitting title now, knowing apparently that 2018 got the better of him to a much greater extent than either of the races that were filmed for this movie showed. And apparently, at least according to Dom, he is calling it a career on the Barkley Marathons. And honestly, this is news to me at this point, but that actually kind of... makes me a bit sad. I was hoping that Where Dreams Go to Die would have some triumphant follow-up where this guy's finally able to make it happen.
Yeah, but given what the race is, someone has to fail in a high-profile way, right?
Like, sure. It wouldn't.
In a way, it would be less satisfying for us, maybe not so for Gary, if he just eventually succeeded at his goal and it was all happily ever after. Someone has to bang the head against the wall and just come away bleeding instead of getting through it.
Right. I genuinely, to go back to this concept, I think Lazarus may say someone coming six seconds away from finishing but not getting there on time is the best case scenario for the Barkley Marathons.
Yeah, it is everything that he wanted to be and everything that the audience fears about it, right?
Yeah. All right, so awesome stuff. Dom, thank you for recommending the Barkley Marathons in the first place and getting me hooked into this whole world. And I know I've said before, but just to put it back out there again so we can give people a bit more of a heads up in terms of lead-in time to watch the movie before the podcast comes out, I think we are both down that the next one we do, which will hopefully be relatively soon, is going to be a movie called Somm, which is available on Netflix. It's spelled S-O-M-M, and it is about what it takes to become a master sommelier, which is apparently a pronunciation Dom takes great issue with.
Oh, we don't need to retread that territory just yet. But yeah, if you've made it to the end of this, you have completed the ultimate endurance challenge. And we salute you for that. And hopefully you'll be back here for some. And yeah, I know that everyone that I and then you have recommended this documentary to has really enjoyed it. So yeah, go out and tell people about it if you enjoyed it too. Tell people about the podcast if you enjoyed the podcast, which is less reliable, but hopefully most of you did as well. And hopefully see you back here for some or for other stuff quite shortly.
Yeah, so Dom is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. You can email the show, domandcolin@gmail.com. Hit us up with your documentary recommendations. We are always both very eager for anything along those lines. And I think with that, there is only one thing left to do.
That was easy.